Jodcast, scuttling out from under your bed with James Bamber, Fiona Healy, Monique Henson, Max Potter, and Benjamin Shaw. The Jodcast, May 2016, Extra Edition. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast. I'm Benjamin Shaw and I'm here with Fiona Healy. Hi, Fiona.
Hi, Ben.
There's someone missing.
Yes, there is. There is someone missing.
Max was meant to be here.
But he's not here.
He's not here yet. So he may show up sometime during the episode, but if not, it's just me and Fiona for now.
Waiting with bated breath.
Indeed. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Ben. I'm better now.
You've had a bit of a rough week.
Oh, Lord. Oh, God. Yeah, yes, I have. It was an eventful few days in my home. Perhaps the terrible events that unfolded were as a result of the beautiful hot weather that we've been having.
And what happened?
Okay, so I was lying in my bed on Sunday night. And I was asleep. And then at about 3 o'clock, I woke up. And I wake up a lot during the night because I've got mice. So I was just there listening to this kind of tick, 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 tick above me. And then I saw something scuttling up the wall, like at eye level, next to my pillows. Oh, God, I'm getting scared just even thinking about it. I didn't have my glasses on, so I couldn't really see what it was. Mm. I could just see this kind of black thing and discovered that it was a massive spider. I mean, you know those kind of horrible river spiders, those big ones with the big bodies and the big hairy legs.
The big death spiders.
The death spiders. It was a death spider.
I've never heard a spider.
Oh my God. It's going to haunt my nightmares. Like, because
well,
you
know, in your waking life already.
You know what struck me about it? Like, what made me think it's not a mouse? I was just like, there is too many legs. That's too many legs. So I went outside and I waited until it was an acceptable hour and I called my neighbour. But he couldn't find him. We couldn't find him. But so that was my week.
Right,
so.
But you're better now. You're with us.
I'm no longer sleep deprived and terrified and okay. I'm doing well and I'm trying to stay calm.
Excellent. Well, in the show this time, Monique interviews Dr. Sambit Roy Chowdhury about dwarf galaxies and Tim O'Brien answers your astronomical questions.
But first, before all of that, Max is interviewing Professor Philippa Browning about her research in this month's JodBite.
Hello, I'm joined with Professor Philippa Browning from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. And we're going to talk a bit about your career, Philippa.
Hi.
Hi. So what sort of stuff are you currently researching? Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm interested particularly in the corona of the sun. So that's the outer atmosphere of the sun that from the Earth you normally only see at a total eclipse. But we have lots of data about the corona, particularly from space telescopes. It turns out one of the interesting things about the corona is the temperature of the corona is about 1 million degrees or more. And that's very surprising when you take into account that the temperature on the surface of the sun, the photosphere, is only 6,000 degrees. Right. So it means basically the sun, if you like, is hot in the middle. It's actually about 15 million degrees. As you would expect, it gets cooler as you come towards the surface. But then you go out into the atmosphere and it starts getting hotter again. And that is obviously not what you'd expect. So one of the things that my research is concerned with is trying to explain that. And I say we have a lot of new data from telescopes in space. So we know a lot more observationally what's going on. But what I'm trying to do is develop theories to really explain that.
That's one of the problems with solar research, isn't it? Because the sun is so easy to observe relatively compared to other astrophysical objects. We've got so much information on it that it's quite difficult to develop a theory that encompasses all of those observational details.
Yes, that's right. We have a lot of, we don't, when you look at a star, you tend to see it more or less as a point, and you get really just its very much overall properties. But we can see, for example, the corona in a vast amount of detail. And we can see it's got all sorts of fine structure, very detailed, lots of loops. And different, some regions are hotter than others, some regions are brighter than others. So very complex structure, also very much changing in time as well. So, you know, bright regions sort of come and go and change. And so trying to develop a model for that is very challenging. So it's one way of looking at it. Of course, we get more data, which is great. But every time you learn more, you also have more to explain, basically. you can't just make up a theory
sure.
and say that's it. You've also got to actually fit the data which
yeah.
is there.
Yeah.
So it's putting those things together is a bit of a challenge, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I know.
Yes.
Yeah. So what are the candidates for explaining that unexpectedly hot corona.
Right. Well, the one thing I think more or less everyone is agreed about is it's something to do with the magnetic field. And we know the corona has a very strong magnetic field. Well, strong in the sense that the magnetic forces are much bigger than any other forces. So if you think you've got the force of gravity, just like in any atmosphere, you know, things are being pulled downwards. You've got the force of pressure, just as you have in the Earth's atmosphere. Basically, it's sort of pressure differences that give you sort of winds and so on in the Earth's atmosphere. And those forces, of course, are there in the corona. But we have also this magnetic force, which is very much stronger. So it's really the magnetic field, which is sort of controlling everything. And we think the coronal heating is to do with getting energy sort of out of the magnetic field and converting it into heat. But there, within that, there are then basically two competing camps. One idea is it's to do with waves. So you imagine taking the ends of the magnetic field line, a bit like just taking hold of one end of a piece of string and shaking it, and you will get waves moving along the string. So we get waves moving along the magnetic field lines. And those waves are carrying energy, and that energy, in principle, can then be converted into heat. The other idea is that we build up what we call some DC, or steady magnetic energy, in the corona. So there it's more, again, perhaps thinking of the magnetic field lines as being rubber bands. If you just slowly stretch a rubber band, you're putting energy into that. And if you were to sort of let it go, it could snap or whatever. So you're getting energy as you just basically stretch or distort the magnetic field lines. And there, a lot of the energy is associated with the fact that the fields can be quite tangled or twisted or whatever. Again, like a bunch of string, you could turn the strings and twist it. You could tangle them up into a big mess. And whenever you do that, you basically got energy there. And we can get that energy out into heat as well. Right. So those are the sort of two competing theories, basically.
Okay. Which one's right?
Nobody knows would be the simple answer. Yeah. Although, of course, a lot of people think they know.
Right.
But I think in terms of explaining the heating of what we call loops, which are the regions where the magnetic field basically comes sort of out of the surface of the sun and goes back in again. And those are actually the hottest plasma and really have the, if you like, where the coronal heating problem is most acute, because you need most heating. It looks like, in terms of explaining the heating of those sort of structures, that the steady magnetic fields, the DC mechanism, is the strongest contender.
Okay.
Whereas waves might be more appropriate, where you have regions where, for example, the magnetic field is open and just sort of connects out into space, and the waves sort of propagate up and into space. But of course, in practice, it may be a combination of the two. We like to sort of divide things into nice categories, and so we've got, you know, one or the other. And as we've said, the corona is very complicated, so it's almost certain that sort of both things are going on. And it's more a question of, well, which is playing the biggest role, and, you know, is the answer like somewhere in the middle, basically.
So you mentioned there that it was regions of hot plasma. Are you interested in plasma physics by itself as well as solar physics? And what about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the interesting things about the corona is that we have this interaction of the magnetic field with the plasma or very hot gas. And that is going on in a lot of other places in the universe, but also in a lot of places on Earth as well. And one example of that is we've got the idea of trying to do fusion on Earth, trying to get energy from fusion, which is actually the same way the sun gets its energy. The sun does it already, but it would be nice to do it on Earth as well, and we could actually, you know, generate electricity. So there, again, you have to have a plasma, a very hot gas. It turns out you need very high temperatures to make fusion work, and you can't just put that into some sort of container. So the trick is to use a magnetic field to confine the plasma. And the idea is you would make a sort of magnetic bottle and use the magnetic field to, say, confine the plasma and then get your fusion to give you your energy. So the processes are really very much the same as what's going on in the solar corona. And in fact, the conditions in many ways are quite comparable. The sort of, you know, the temperatures are quite similar and so on. So it's a sort of two-way process. If we study the corona, we learn more about plasma physics and magnetic fields, and we can apply that to these magnetically confined fusion plasmas, and obviously the other way around as well. So one field can very much learn from another, and that's something. So I have also done work on magnetically confined fusion plasmas, again, trying to basically develop theoretical models of how they behave.
Okay. So how long is it before we have nuclear fusion on Earth till we can not worry about energy anymore?
That's the big question. Things are making considerable progress, and they are currently well on the way to building what's called ITER, which is a big tokamak kind of experimental reactor in the south of France that should really demonstrate the feasibility of fusion power, but won't yet be an actual reactor. It certainly won't generate any electricity. It's not designed to do that. It's just designed to demonstrate the processes. So that's well underway now. And hopefully after that, we could start on actually building a demonstration fusion reactor. So people say by about the middle of the century, we could at least have a sort of working electricity demonstration. If not an actual, you might not necessarily be getting your electricity from that process yet.
Right, sure.
But it would be close
it's,
to that.
It's the classic 30 to 40 years from now.
That seems to be about it, yes. But I think now we've actually got a much clearer view of what the steps are to get from where we are to where we want to be.
Sure.
But there are lots of problems. There's obviously, you know, potentially scientific problems. There's still to be overcome. There's engineering problems. And there's also sort of political problems, actually, you know, getting people to sort of pay for it and
yeah,
work
I heard
together
there was a bit of
and
difficulty
so on.
With the American Congress recently.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're having a sort of review of their participation. And it's very difficult getting a lot of teams from, you know, really virtually all over the world to work together on one big project.
True.
That takes an awful lot of coordination. And
yeah, it's enormously expensive as well. So
it is, but not compared with a lot of other things.
Okay.
We spend money on.
Fair enough. That's true.
Yeah, if you think of the potential benefits,
yeah,
it's actually, you know, in some sense, not that expensive, I think.
So what do you think we have to look forward to over the next, in the near future, in terms of solar physics?
Well, in terms of solar physics, the exciting thing coming up on the observational side is Solar Orbiter, which I think is hopefully going to be launched in 2018. And Solar Orbiter is going to go basically really close to the sun, about almost a fifth of the distance from the sun that the Earth is. So pretty close. And so it's going to be sitting in the solar wind very close to the sun and basically picking up the stuff as it comes out of the sun and measuring it directly. But at the same time, it's going to be looking at the sun with telescopes and looking at the surface of the sun. So we'll be getting that kind of connection between what's happening in the low corona very close to the surface of the sun and what's coming sort of further out as you get close to the Earth, and be able to sort of directly link those things together.
Okay.
So you will, for example, see some kind of, you know, event like a flare or something near the surface of the sun. You'll sort of watch that going on, and then all the particles from that will sort of propagate outwards, and then they'll, you know, you'll be at the spacecraft and just basically watch them go by and measure their properties.
Wow, okay.
So you can sort of make the connection and gradually start to link things together. So that's obviously a very exciting mission. No, we've never done that. We've never gone that close to the sun before. Usually we're looking at it from spacecraft, which are really very near the Earth, at the sort of same distance from the sun as the Earth is.
Yeah.
And the other thing also Solar Orbiter will do is it will basically fly out of the ecliptic plane. So the Earth is always going in, you know, an orbit, which is effectively more or less around the equator of the sun. So we're only, you know, always sort of basically seeing the sun from one angle. And it's very difficult to sort of know what's going on near the poles of the sun. So Solar Orbiter will sort of fly out of the ecliptic. So it'll be basically looking down at the sun from the top and from the bottom, if that makes sense. So
we'll
be seeing the sort of top and the bottom of the sun, as
right.
well as the sides of it.
Yeah.
And that's very important in terms of understanding the magnetic field.
Yeah.
And if you think even of, say, the magnetic field of the Earth, you know, there's like a magnetic north pole and a magnetic south pole. And so if you want to understand the Earth's magnetic field, if you don't know what's going on near the poles, it's like you're never going to understand it. So we really have to sort of understand those polar regions of the sun and know what's going on there to understand sort of how the magnetic field is working. And again, obviously from the Earth, we're, you know, we're kind of trapped where we are. We can only look at it from one perspective.
Yeah, sure.
So this will give us something quite different. So I think that's the thing to watch out for, Solar Orbiter.
Okay, and when's that coming online?
Well, I say it should be launched in 2018. But it will take it a while. It has to go by a rather circuitous route to get to the sun. It's actually surprisingly, you can't just send something directly towards the sun because of the fact that you're already got the orbital motion of the Earth. So you have to swing round, I think it's Jupiter, to get back. So it'll take it a while, but it will start doing stuff on the way as well, I think.
Okay.
And I think it'll be in about the 2020s when we start getting the really interesting data back.
All right. Well, before we go, actually, you told me something interesting recently about some outreach events that you were doing. Just wondered if you wanted to give a quick shout out to those.
Yeah. There's something very different. I just got a little bit involved with an event involving dance and the life cycle of stars. So it will be involving a few schools and colleges from Manchester who are going to be learning different dances, which will be related to how stars are born. And that actually also involves another of our colleagues, Rowan Smith from Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. And then moving on, how sort of stars, you know, stars become, well, our sun is obviously just a star. Mm. So it will be, you know, teaching children then about our sun and trying to understand the fact that the sun is a star and how it behaves. So they will learn about flares and magnetic fields and also how important the sun is for the Earth. But I say they will be doing that through actually developing dances, which is obviously very unusual.
Yeah.
But you can sort of imagine it, there's a lot of twisting and sort of coming together and passing on energy and all that.
Yeah.
So I think that's a very exciting way for children to learn about science.
Yeah.
And
it's very inventive.
Yeah, and I'm sure it will stick in their minds in a way that perhaps a science lesson in the conventional way wouldn't. So.
Well, hopefully. Okay, so there we have it, interpretive dance and solar physics.
Yes.
All right, well, thank you very much, Professor Philippa Browning. I guess we'll speak to you next time.
Yeah, thank you very much. Bye.
Thanks for that, Max.
Now, Monique interviews Dr. Sambit Roy-Chowdhury about dwarf galaxies.
Hi, I'm here with Sambit Roy-Chowdhury from MPA in Gashing. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, it's a pleasure.
And this is your first time on the Jodcast, I believe.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. And although you're at Gashing at the moment, you're coming over to Manchester in the not-too-distant future?
Yes, in a couple of months.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that'd be good to have you here. If we just want to start off by talking a little bit about what you do.
Okay, so my interests primarily lie in these small galaxies, which are found kind of around the larger galaxies, like the Milky Way, in which we inhabit. These galaxies are called dwarf galaxies. They are orders of magnitude smaller in mass, fainter in magnitude, but turns out quite important in the larger scheme of things, especially when you think about how the structure in the present day universe has evolved and how it looks the way it looks, why it looks the way it looks. And if you go back in time, right after the Big Bang, when the first galaxies were formed, what we think today is that the first galaxies that formed are really small, kind of the dwarf galaxies that I'm interested in today. And as time progressed, these small galaxies kind of coalesced or joined together to form the larger galaxies, which we dominate the mass in the present day universe. And those are the galaxies that are so easy to see all around us. So to understand that critical phase in the just after the birth of the universe, when the first structures and the first galaxies were forming, it's important to understand how, when I mean by galaxies were forming, how there was some kind of gravitational potential or dark matter, we don't know much about it, into which the first hydrogen, the hydrogen that was all around, fell into that dark matter potential, created a disk. So you have a hydrogen disk, and then that hydrogen got converted into stars. So we need to understand how this process happened in the first galaxies, and thereafter we can make a better sense of the rest of the progression of the universe. So my work mainly has been to look at these nearby dwarf galaxies, which we can study in some amount of detail, and the ones which have some amount of fuel or hydrogen left from which stars are formed, to look into those galaxies and try to understand how this fuel is converted into stars. So that's been my main research, and I've been doing other smaller stuff around, but we can talk about it.
Yeah,
if
there's
needed.
Plenty of time for that. So you study these kind of smaller galaxies, and you said these formed first, and that's what the larger galaxies were made of when those kind of came together. Mm. But now you're particularly looking at these nearby small galaxies. Mm. So are the ones that are nearby, are they really, really...
Similar
to the kind of the first galaxies, or are they actually like different in subtle ways?
That's a very good question. They are actually... We do understand that they should not be similar, because... Mm. The environment in which they formed, let's put it in that way, was very different when the universe was young. Warmer, much more ways to, you know, ionize the gas, not enough metals around, and other processes which were taking place at the early universe. So the environment was different. The environment today is much, much calmer, let's say. But in some ways, you have to start at some point, right? So these galaxies are nearby. But still, it's only recently that we are slowly attaining the capabilities, which will be enhanced a little more if the Square Kilometer Array comes around, to actually look at the gas in these galaxies in some detail. Still, there are so many unsolved issues because we just cannot absorb them because they are so small. The whole entire amount of signal from various different kinds of phases of the ISM that are coming in. ISM means interstellar medium, anything other than the stars that exist in a galaxy. The signals that come in from various phases of that interstellar medium are still, especially some phases like the molecular phase, the gas which is in molecular form, is still so faint, especially for the really faint ones, even if they're nearby, that they're very difficult to study. Mm-hmm. So we are kind of doing a first step thing, trying to understand what is happening here, and we'll make an educated guess about what can be the slight differences in the early universe and how that might affect things. Mm-hmm. Generally, that educated guess comes in the form of simulations, where people try to simulate the present structure in the universe by starting from the very basics numerically and in different ways. And there, these kind of assumptions and relations and what you understand, they are put in as input to see if we can finally match with what we are seeing. So that's the way the whole game is played. But so therefore, observations are crucial to start this process. So that's basically it.
So they kind of go hand in hand, the observations and simulations, because they offer you different insights.
In some sense, yes. Though I'm not very sure how much... It's starting more, but I am not very sure how much crosstalk there is between these two kind of studies.
Yeah.
But for anyone working in this sort of areas where you know that your final aim is to understand the structure around the universe, and by the structure I mean much larger than what our galaxy itself, beyond our galaxy, beyond our local cluster, beyond maybe our supercluster, to understand this whole grand scheme of things that we see around us. So when you are working in either sense, there has to be some amount of crosstalk, though it's not always the case, but I guess that's how it should be.
Yeah, I think there's lots of cases of that in research, though, where there should be more interaction than there is between different groups. So the impression I'm getting is whilst you're studying this kind of some of the smaller objects, that's giving you an insight into the larger scale of the universe. So you mentioned that you're particularly like trying to observe the interstellar medium, so the gas and dust in these small galaxies. And you said it's very difficult to observe the molecular hydrogen you're looking at in these galaxies. So why are you particularly interested in molecular hydrogen rather than ionized hydrogen?
So both from theoretical considerations as well as more and more recent observations of galaxies around us and our own galaxy, molecular clouds are like the nurseries where stars are forming. So detailed observations show that it's, as I told you, as you kind of expected, the phase that correlates best with star formation is first of all the really dense gas which collapses to form stars, and that dense gas is kind of cocooned inside the molecular hydrogen, which basically is the fuel of star formation. So the molecular hydrogen collapses gravitationally, and that forms stars. So you kind of expected it, and it's being seen that the molecular hydrogen is related to star formation. The tough thing about molecular hydrogen is because of the structure of the molecule, it's very hard to observe. It doesn't have any strong detectable emission lines, which is our favorite way of observing stuff, right?
So the wavelength that it emits at isn't very specific to molecular hydrogen.
That would have been fine. It is very faint. The transition is because of it's a very symmetric molecule, and you don't really have a transition which is strong enough to be observed. There is, but it's very faint.
It gets drowned out by everything else around it.
Yes, that's always the issue, right? You have to detect it. So the favorite way of people to locate where molecular hydrogen will be was to look for the next two most abundant elements, which are carbon and oxygen. Okay, let me keep aside helium for the moment. Just carbon, the next two ones, carbon and oxygen, and they form this molecule, the carbon monoxide molecule, which is generally found in these molecular cloud complexes. There is a way to relate the amount of emission you're observing from this carbon monoxide molecule with the amount of hydrogen there is. Now, the issue comes in I briefly probably mentioned, in these kind of small galaxies, metals are less. Metals are generally formed through star formation. So in the first galaxies, there would have been almost no metals. Then the first stars came, they blew up in supernovae. The metals were ejected into the galaxy, then out of the galaxy, maybe into the medium around the galaxy called the circumgalactic medium. Then as later generations of galaxies formed and coalesced together, these materials from the circumgalactic medium was again absorbed into the galaxy, and they stayed there. These metals, mainly in the form of dust grains, are very crucial in forming this molecular hydrogen from which the stars will form itself. There are a couple of ways in which they are crucial for this molecular hydrogen to form. Now, the thing is, if the metals are less, what happens is throughout the galaxy, there's a very strong field of ultraviolet radiation that is created by older stars that have formed, even sometimes background quasars and stuff. But let's say the older stars that have formed. So this ultraviolet field that runs through the galaxy, the hydrogen needs to be shielded against it so that it can convert from the atomic to the molecular phase. Atomic hydrogen is the most abundant element. It's everywhere, but it's warm generally. It is in various kind of phases. Much of it is warm. Some of it is cold. You have to turn it from the warm to the cold first. And cold atomic hydrogen will go to the molecular hydrogen phase. And to do that, you need metals or dust to shield it. Now, if the metallicity is lower, maybe the hydrogen is forming. This carbon monoxide is even more critically dependent whether it forms on this metallicity because of the same shielding effect. The carbon and oxygen atoms should exist as atoms. Then they should join together to form the molecule. For all of this to happen, the background field should be shielded against. So what happens is, in these kind of low metallicity environments, the hydrogen was supposed to be traced by carbon monoxide, but maybe for similar amount of hydrogen that is present, the amount of carbon monoxide that is present falls very quickly. So now this, not only do you have intrinsically less amount of hydrogen because these are small galaxies, right? Even if the ratio of molecular hydrogen to carbon monoxide was same, you would have had a smaller signal. Now it is compounded by the fact that with the metallicity and hence the dust going down, that amount of carbon monoxide is falling exponentially, let's say.
Because you don't have the shielding, which means that it can't cool and it can't form. I see.
So it's very difficult to, not only necessarily in these galaxies, even the say, very outskirts and low metallicity regions of spiral galaxies, large spiral galaxies, it's very difficult to observe carbon monoxide and therefore to interpret how much hydrogen there is. Therefore, this is the basic problem. People are trying to get around the issue by many ways. Also, I am sure people may have heard about the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, the ALMA, which has come over. So ALMA is a much more sensitive instrument, which has already been started to be used by various people to look at the carbon monoxide emission in these kind of smaller galaxies. So things will change, but it's still difficult to do for these kind, particularly this kind of galaxies.
So, something I just wanted to clarify is, I know when astronomers talk about metals, they often mean something quite different to what most people think of as metals.
Right, I should have explained that. Yes.
Oh, no, that's...
So anything other than hydrogen and helium are metals.
Yeah, it's one of those things astronomers, kind of everything except for hydrogen and helium is a metal.
Yes.
But it's good to clarify
yes,
that
yes,
one.
Yes, of course. It's not like the iron and nickel. And of course, they are also there.
They're included. Yeah.
Yes, but they're in so minuscule proportions compared to the... I think mostly metallicities are measured by measuring the emission from generally much was less atomic number elements like carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, stuff like
so
that.
So the lighter elements, just because there's much more of them, I suppose.
Yes, means you can at least detect it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the other stuff is very hard to detect, except from stars maybe.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you're kind of hoping that ALMA will lead for some developments in this area. Like, do you think it's the kind of thing where you'll see kind of big breakthroughs with ALMA, or are you really waiting for the SKA before you can get anywhere?
So they will look at very different things. As I mentioned, ALMA is probably for looking at the molecular gas in some sense, and through using other submillimeter instruments and arrays, people have already started pushing the limits for observing the molecular hydrogen in these kind of low metallicity, small star-forming galaxies, which exist around the big galaxies. ALMA will push it. It depends. It's not very clear how. Only time will tell.
Yep.
Because ALMA can observe at very high resolutions. Mm-hmm. So it is, for the moment, I guess, we are picking out the same molecular clouds, the central or the very dense positions, portions of these clouds. The atomic hydrogen from which this molecular hydrogen is supposed to form, the present day interferometers that are used observe at a much coarser resolution. So in that sense, when SKA comes along, it will be sensitive, better resolution. In all these terms, it will be better. But as you can understand, they're probing kind of two different phases.
Very different regimes.
And phases of the ISM. But there are ways to probe maybe the molecular hydrogen content through other lines too, not necessarily the carbon monoxide line. Or you can go take a circuitous route using dust. So all these kind of possibilities exist. So any ALMA breakthrough in this area will not create maybe as much of a buzz as it is creating regarding, say, planetary disks or various other stuff. Because it's not very much in the consciousness of people. It's not a very... How should I put it? It's not a very, very...
Fashionable
area, yes. So, but whatever we understand of the process might have much deeper and much longer lasting effect on the way we understand structure formation. Because, well, maybe this is time to mention the two things that anyone who works on dwarf galaxies does mention. There are some very interesting things that affect especially the dwarf galaxy end. What do you mean by effect? Mismatches between what is observed and what is predicted from these kind of simulations. And there are a couple of big mismatches both affecting this dwarf galaxy end. And what are the mismatches? One of them is the, for some time now, the simulations which mainly trace the major amount of mass that is in the universe, which is dark matter, and how this dark matter evolves with time and how the structures are formed, and then post facto put in gas and then star formation on these dark matter structures. Yes, because it's computationally you have to set limits. Those are limits that are being pushed. When it was done in this way, what was found was the amount of dwarf galaxies that you should have seen as you go down in mass. So it's basically a function of how many galaxies in a particular range of mass should exist. So you go down, it should continuously increase according to dark matter.
So you have more and more smaller things.
And not only more and more, a huge number of them. Observationally, it was nowhere as close. There were orders of magnitude difference, not even going to very low masses.
So is this the missing satellites problem?
This is basically the missing satellites problem. Okay, so this is one of the things. People have been, some very clever people have been trying to find out ways to understand why it's happening in this way. And there are promising leads to understand what might be happening, why the reality is different from what you might naively interpret just by looking at, say, dark matter potentials. And if you understand the physics a little bit more, and that's why this physics comes in.
So you really have to understand how the gas is converting
into stars and how... And this is crucial, how the stars in turn affect the gas. Because stars put in energy into the gas. They disturb the gas around it. They sometimes blow out the gas. And this happens a lot in the small galaxies. And the second mismatch that was happening between what was predicted from these kind of dark matter simulations and observations was how the mass profile, how much mass there is with the increasing radius varies between what is observed, or at least interpreted from observations, and what is expected from these dark matter simulations. How the dark matter mass profile should be and how we observe it to be. So this was basically the core cusp problem.
Yep.
Okay. Even here, sometimes very similar kind of effects, like the same thing I told you, how stars affect the gas and in turn the dark matter gravitationally, are promising to be the major solution towards these kind of problems. So these small galaxies, which were kind of in the backwaters of astronomy for a long time, are turning out to be very crucial players. And even though what they kind of do not have in impact in terms of mass or brightness, they're kind of making up in terms of how they actually control stuff before. And so this is one of the issues. Maybe this is a time where I should quickly relate to one of your previous questions about the dwarfs that formed right after the beginning of the universe and the present comes in. That might be one of the reasons why this discrepancy in number counts, the missing satellites problems, that has been suggested as one of the reasons that in the early universe, there was a certain cutoff, which was applied due to physical reasons on the mass of the dark matter halo, which could form dwarf galaxies. So there are a lot of dark matter halos which just kept hanging around there without finally forming galaxies. So that is one of the ways to solve the problem.
Clumps of dark matter, but without any gas and stars in them.
Yes.
So we wouldn't see them because they wouldn't be bright.
That's the thing. So I am not an expert in this field, so I don't know how people might have thought about observing them. So there are cases, I think, where there have been claims of finding a dark galaxy which has gas, but no stars. Okay.
Oh, wow. That's still an interesting point in itself.
Or really faint galaxies which have a lot of gas in them, but very little amount of star formation. So all these kind of things exist. In many ways, we are at the very beginning of our understanding. So new observations come in every day. Various kind of claims are happening. A lot of galaxies are sometimes being found in a survey, very faint ones. There have been recent papers which have come out about finding lots of small galaxies. But so at some point, we will sit down and, you know, put everything together, but it's very much an active field, trying and we're trying to understand what is going on.
But that makes it an exciting place to be, right?
Yes, of course.
And I think as well, like, so you've kind of got two points on it, and from the observational point of view, you're just getting to the point now where you can start making some good observations and getting more numbers. But then on the simulation point of view as well, they've probably in the past struggled with resolution, and as you were saying, they've massively relied on just looking at dark matter and not thinking about all of the astrophysics. And maybe in the next few years we'll be at a point where they can actually get some of the astrophysics in as well.
No, the astrophysics is already there, but it was limited by the limitations of the observations themselves.
Oh, right, okay.
Right, because
so we just don't have enough information yet.
Yes, so and it's as it will get better, the observations will get better, the recipes, the equations that are put in will become more and more refined. Okay, and so it's a back and forth process. I think dark matter simulations have been a huge success story overall. Just that using a supercomputer, you can almost create an entire universe. It's quite fascinating. And so it's just a matter of probably fine-tuning and trying to understand. And the thing is, if everything was explained, then where will be the fun? How will you
That's
learn?
That's true. We'd be out of a job.
So the science comes out from the mismatches. Once you see that, okay, there is a difference between what you're observing and what you're seeing, you try to understand what is the physical process which caused this mismatch. So that's where the science comes from. And you'll continuously do it. And hopefully that will keep many people interested in science, astrophysics, and the bigger questions. And it'll continue. That's all.
Yeah. So it's a really good point. Thank you for coming on the Jodcast.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure. And thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll have you on again in the future.
Thanks for that, Monique. So, a few housekeeping things. Our survey has gone live.
Oh, that's really exciting. I'm so excited. Have we had any responses yet?
We've had about 30 responses, most of them positive so far.
Oh, wow. Oh, fantastic. Oh, can I look? Can we look?
You can. We'll send you a link.
Please do.
But, yeah, we have no internet here in the studio, so we can't.
I love hearing what people think of us. It's fantastic.
Yes. Yeah, you like surveys.
I love surveys, and I love data, and I love collecting information, and it's just my favourite thing in the whole world.
How many times have you filled in this survey?
29 times. I'm only joking.
So there is a link to the survey on our Facebook page and on our Twitter page, or you can just go to jodcast.net/survey. Please do fill it in. It'd be really good to know what you think, if there's anything you think we should change, if there's anything you think we're doing well. If you think it's absolutely abysmal, that's all well and good, but please tell us why. Tonight, I'll be in a suit. Don't laugh.
It's true, he will be in a suit.
I will be in a suit.
He's so going to the Make a Difference Awards,
yeah,
which we've been nominated for.
We have. So you may remember from a while ago, we won the Better Worlds Award, which was the Engineering and Physical Sciences Division's internal award for things that make a better world.
And we got a biodegradable plaque, which I really take issue with, because you want a plaque to last forever.
Well, this one won't. It will biodegrade.
Biodegrade, if much we win like this one, the Jodcast and all of mankind's achievements.
I guess so, yeah. It's ultimately futile.
Yeah.
But this award is very much the same award, but this is a university-wide award, so we are up against some quite stiff competition, including the Jodrell Bank Discovery Centre itself.
Oh, wow. So, interesting.
So Charlie and I are going off to a swanky do tonight at Whitworth Hall in Manchester, where we'll be sat around a big round table and hopefully come back with an award of some kind.
Will they give you food?
There is a buffet lunch or a buffet dinner.
Buffet dinner? Yes. Oh, my God.
Well, by the time this goes out, you'll hear how we've done. So we'll keep you posted.
Well, hopefully.
Yes.
Maybe we'll get ourselves a biodegradable trophy.
Maybe. You never know. Anyway, did you see the transit of Mercury?
I did not, because that was on Monday and I was avoiding the sun because I was sleep deprived.
Because of the spider.
Because of the spider. Right. But other people saw it. Everyone in my office was all excited. They were like, Fiona, do you want to come out to the roof? We're looking at the transit of Mercury. And I was like,
you're going to stay underground in the server room.
Yeah, I was just hiding. I was just hiding under a blanket on the armchair in my office, trying to sleep. It was sad.
Sam and Rukyard and I went up to the top of the car park, which is adjacent to this building, to see if we could see it. I took my eclipse glasses.
Oh, did you?
We knew we had no chance to see
it. But, like, you didn't have any kind of magnifying equipment whatsoever?
None whatsoever. I was hoping that I would discover that I had better than average eyesight.
Okay, how did that go?
I saw the sun, I saw nothing on it.
Poor Mercury.
So, yeah, I didn't see it either, but I tried, that's all I can do. Yoda the Oat, the guy that runs our Flickr group, posted a nice picture of the transit on Twitter, which I think we've retweeted, so check that out. Yeah. So we should also mention that we had some quite interesting cover art from the last episode. There's a man called Travelling Matt 72, Matt with one T, who's a Twitter user who is called Matt and travels, apparently.
Or else it's some sort of flying carpet.
So far, we only have a degenerate solution for that, yeah, I guess. apparently he makes quite a few of these images, and Charlie managed to get his permission to use one of those. So check out some more of his work at TravellingMatt72 on Twitter.
So now we move on to the part of the show where we talk about all the things that didn't really fit in anywhere else.
Sure, so you've heard probably multiple times in the past various accounts of what we think the sun might do when it expands to become a red giant and what the fate of the Earth might be. So we've long heard differing opinions on what the ultimate fate of the Earth is when the sun finally leaves the main sequence. Some have claimed that the Earth will survive. Others have predicted that it'll be completely engulfed. And one group even suggested a few years ago that Venus might survive, which would be...
Should we all move to Venus? But Venus is nearer to the sun.
Nearer to the sun. So this group suggested that Venus might just be okay.
We shouldn't move to Venus, because if Venus is going to be okay, we're going to be okay.
Exactly. Yeah, so okay, we should be fine. Okay. However, we don't think that's going to happen. Two scientists from Mexico and the UK have calculated what they think might happen using the latest in what we know about how the sun will evolve. So what's the future for the sun? For about 4.5 billion years, it's been happily burning its core supply of hydrogen, turning it into helium on what we call the main sequence of stellar evolution. Sooner or later, though, this supply will run out in about 5 or 6 billion years, so no need to panic quite yet. So at this point, the core of the sun will begin to contract, and a shell of hydrogen around the now inert core will begin to burn into helium.
Okay, so once it's finished with the core, it starts burning the next bit out.
Yeah, so it'll collapse inwards, the shell will ignite, there'll be an inert core, and there'll be hydrogen burning, and the helium, because it's heavier, will sink to the centre and build up a helium core for the sun. As they expand outwards, they cool to a red colour, and that's when we talk about the star being on the red giant branch of stellar evolution. Now, during its post-main sequence evolution, the sun will lose quite a lot of its mass. And so as the mass of the sun has dropped, the gravitational attraction between it and the planets will change and the planets will move outwards. Their orbits will expand.
So it's going to be getting bigger, but we're going to be getting further away.
So the question is, will the planets move away fast enough such that they can escape the expanding
It's good to be like
sun.
A kind of an Indiana Jones type situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
So what these people have done, this, they've calculated this using models that account in detail for how we think the sun will lose envelope mass, which has been a big sort of uncertainty in interstellar evolution models up until now. And they find that Mercury and Venus are engulfed. Not really any surprise there. But in these calculations, the Earth goes the same way, unfortunately. It doesn't move out far enough or fast enough for us to escape the growing sun.
So but at least we're trying.
So happy, happy, joy, joy. We're going to be homeless.
Yeah.
But it's not lost because with the evolution of the sun, not only will the Earth move outwards, but the habitable zone will also move outwards.
Oh.
And actually what they've calculated is that as the sun expands, the habitable zone will actually move out into the Kuiper Belt.
No,
and
that
a lot
one.
Of water in the Kuiper Belt, which will then become liquid. Just for a reminder, the habitable zone is the region around any star at which the temperatures are favourable for water to exist as a liquid, which we think is a prerequisite for life as we know it. There has to be some sort of condensable solvent.
Mm-hmm.
If you go too far towards the star, water can't condense. If you go too far, out from the star, water is a solid. And so these people think the habitable zone will include some of the Kuiper Belt, given there's currently lots of ice out there.
The Kuiper Belt is the one beyond Pluto.
Yeah, Pluto and beyond Kuiper Belt for a while until we reach the Kuiper Belt cliff. And
now, didn't it take Voyager like 70 years to get out there?
Yeah.
So hadn't we better leave like, okay, no, actually, no, we're good because it's going to be 6 billion years before this happens.
It's going to be 6 billion years before this happens. But the problem with that is there is a caveat in that the sun is slowly growing in its luminosity. And so it is getting hotter. So the Earth over the next few hundred thousand years will get hotter.
Yes.
So we actually haven't got that long to do it.
So we better start making tracks for the Kuiper Belt soon.
So before this happens, we better find an intermediate home somewhere in the middle of the solar system before we end up moving out to the Kuiper Belt.
Well, we can't really live on Jupiter. There's not really a solid surface there, is there?
No.
Oh, but the moons. We could live on
maybe
one of the moons.
Maybe moons,
like Titan.
We could terraform Titan.
Yeah. Titan's a scary place. There's lots of weird stuff in Titan, though. This is all the things. Is that the one with all the strange things in the frozen sea with the volcanoes and the...
It's eerily Earth-like. I think it's largely methane. Methane's
like
condensable the same way that waters are condensable here. So
sounds like the start of a sci-fi horror movie. Hey, let's all go to Titan. It's going to be great.
But if we go to Titan, we might find the Huygens probe, which would be cool.
Oh, that would be cool. Yeah,
I would like to find that.
So Ben's going to go off and look for the Huygens probe. And we'll get back to you.
Excellent.
So now, I'm gonna talk about my odd and end, and we're all going to learn some new words, or at least I learned some new words today, because I was looking up my odd and end on the bus this morning, and usually that's something I can pull off, because usually my odd and ends don't take me that long to learn about. But this one was both really interesting but slightly complicated, but I was like, no. So anyway, I'm reporting to you today about the Sentinel's first map of the sea surface, which was being talked about today on the BBC. So to fill you in there what that is. Firstly, before we go any further, it was news to me, and it may be news to you, that the sea isn't the same height all the way around. So you know when we talk about like sea level, that's not really a thing. So it's actually variable in its levels. Some bits it's higher and some bits it's... In fact, on the BBC, they describe it as hills and valleys.
On the sea surface.
On the sea surface.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I know. I was just... Because all the literature I've been able to find about this has accepted this as a given and doesn't give any explanation as to like, what? Wait, hang on, hold up. Why is it not the same level all the way around? Because you know, everything we learn about physics and liquids and fluids tells us, no, it'll just be the same, it'll be flat, but it's not flat.
But it's not, it has topography.
Yeah, it has topography. So that led me on to learning about the Sentinel satellites, which are satellites that have been launched by the Copernicus Project. So the Copernicus seems to be a venture of the ESA, and its mission is to find out all stuff about the Earth. So they're just interested in looking at Earth, mm-hmm. not the other planets, just Earth. So they've sent up a bunch of satellites called the Sentinels. I think they're up to Sentinel 6 at the moment.
Right.
which all have different little responsibilities in terms of finding out different things about what's happening on the surface of the Earth. And so Sentinel-3A is the one that's been looking at the oceans. And they have just released their first map of the ocean topography. And you can see very clearly in it that some bits, so the bits that are, they're kind of measuring it against a reference, which is some data that was taken in the 1990s. But even then in the 90s, they seem to be aware that the sea wasn't the same level all the way around. This just seems to be news to me and Ben today, which is a bit strange because we're really very clever. But anyway.
might be.
I don't know. anyway, so the higher up bits are indicative of warmer sea temperatures. So in other words, so they're calling them anomalies. The bits that are higher than kind of the reference level are called anomalies. And positive anomalies, so the higher up bits, are associated with warmer waters and a deeper thermocline. The thermocline is the transition layer. It's the layer between where the warm water at the top of the ocean meets the colder water beneath. So the kind of the layer between those two sections of the ocean, as it were, is called the thermocline.
So it's more of a step in temperature.
Yeah, exactly.
Gradient.
Yeah, that's it. There's kind of a cold bit and a hot bit, and then the thermocline is sort of the bit where those are sort of mixing in and meeting.
So when you say the height, what are they measuring the height with respect to?
So what they say here is that they're measuring it with respect to a historical data set gathered by satellite altimeters since the early 1990s. Right. So I don't think they're even measuring it with respect to one fixed level.
Yeah.
They've always known it had different levels. It's news to me, but they've always known. it's just that even since the 1990s, the levels have been changing. Yeah. And of course, what this is all pointing towards is global warming and generally rising sea levels. But what they're noticing is that the sea levels aren't rising all at the same time. They're not all rising at the same rate, depending on where you are in the planet.
Right.
So what they're hoping to gather is some more detailed information about how sea levels are changing, so that we can know which bits to evacuate first, I guess. Because also in the news this week, depressingly, was a story about how, I think, was it 5 tropical islands so far have just been completely swallowed.
Out, yeah.
Yeah. So it's a serious, real problem, you know? And so I think what they're doing here, and it sounds like a fascinating project. So all the different sentinels are gathering different kinds of data about the sea and the land. I mean, another thing that Sentinel-3A does is gather data about the colour of the ocean, because that tells us things about, like, algae blooms and stuff, which is also affected by global warming. And they gather all this data up. And it's really exciting for me because I love data. I kind of want a job with these people now.
It does sound like a cool job. It'd also be interesting to see how the height of the sea level scales with the local surface gravity as well.
Yes, exactly. I mean, maybe perhaps they correct for that. I don't know. I'm like, you know, they're saying in the map that they show on the BBC, you can identify the Gulf Stream, you know, because that's a different temperature to the rest of it. And so it's just, it never crossed my mind that, I mean, obviously we know that different bits of the ocean are hotter than other bits, but it never crossed my mind that that would correspond to a higher level as such. So that's and it affects things like currents, which makes sense, I guess. Mm. It makes sense that if there's currents, it's probably because there's, you know, maybe pressure differences. Yeah. One bit being higher than another might influence that. So it's really interesting. And actually, what I'm not really talking about here, but what I think is also interesting, is how the satellites themselves actually worked. They had a bunch of different satellites all flying together in formation. And the name for that, the name for a bunch of satellites all flying off together, is called a constellation, which is really cool.
It's a very cool name.
It is really cool. It's cute. They have a constellation of satellites, and that's how it was really quite technical and detailed how they even gathered this information, because obviously they wanted to get complete coverage of the Earth, and they needed to correct for like tides and things. So it's really, really cool. The BBC have a really nice article about it, which we'll link you to, and we'll also link you to the Copernicus website, so you can find out more information for yourselves about this this exciting project. And now for someone whose knowledge is far above sea level, Professor Tim O'Brien answers your questions in Ask an Astronomer.
For this month's Ask an Astronomer, we are joined by Professor Tim O'Brien. I get the impression that Tim is one of the busiest people on the planet right now, so I'm very grateful that he's been able to join us. Charlie tells me it's been about 2 years since you were last on the Jobcast.
We did look it up. It was January 2014.
January 2014. So what have you been up to since then?
I think I got busy because I started spending half my time being an associate dean, which is a sort of administrative job in the faculty. So 50% of the time I was doing that, plus the other 150% of the time I was doing other things. So yeah, I think I fell off the Jobcast wagon.
Yeah.
But I'm getting back on, so that's good.
Okay, I've actually heard you in the media quite a lot recently, chatting about Blue Dot Festival.
Blue Dot's going to be great, I think. It's a music and science festival at Jodrell Bank at the end of July, so still tickets available if anybody's interested in buying one. If you look at discovertheBlueDot.com, you'll find all the information. But it's basically building on some things we did back in 2011 to 2013, where we had music festivals at Jodrell. So bands like Elbow and Sigur Rós and New Order and these sorts of people. And then alongside music, we had some sort of science festival as well. But what we're doing this time is running it as a full sort of camping festival over the weekend. So this year we've got Jean-Michel Jarre, if you've heard of Jean-Michel Jarre.
I absolutely have done, yeah.
So he's playing on the Saturday, and we've got Underworld, who are quite an interesting electronic band, Caribou as well, Public Service Broadcasting. Got Brian Cox and Robin Ince doing a recording of their Infinite Monkey Cage. Loads of stuff, so loads of science, loads of art and technology as well as the music, so it should be great fun.
So there's no excuse really for any listeners not to go to this.
I think if you're the sort of person who listens to the Jobcast, you're the sort of person who ought to go to Blue Dot.
Excellent. So what was the website for that again?
It's discovertheBlueDot.com.
Okay.
And I should say Blue Dot in case you haven't picked it up. Is a nod to Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot.
Yes.
So the sort of the planet Earth in space as a seen from a distance as a little blue dot. So it's all basically about, you know, space and also what we do on the planet. So sort of human creativity, really, as well as science, music, art, and so on.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you for that. So let's have a look at the questions. So, as ever, we have three listener-submitted questions. Our first one is from Christoph Cranbull, who asks, what single space mission would you launch in the next 10 years if money was no constraint?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a challenging question, but I thought it was fun anyway. I think actually having constraints is a good thing.
Yep.
Because actually, it usually drives a bit of creativity, actually. If somebody said to you, money's no object, what would you do? Because anything's possible, it's almost impossible to decide what you want. So it's almost a good idea to have sort of a, you know, budget, and then you can achieve the maximum you can by being sort of creative. But in these terms, I guess, one of the things we'd always fancy doing, certainly speaking from a radio astronomy background, if we were thinking about, say, doing radio astronomy from space, then I think the idea of building a radio telescope on the far side of the moon would be a nice thing. So you basically block the radio interference of the Earth is blocked by the moon. It's very quiet. That's always a challenge for us in radio astronomy is all the interference we get terrestrially. Low gravity, so you could build it really big because the structure would be easy to build a large structure. No wind. That's the other problem that, you know, we have in radio astronomy is wind might blow our big telescopes down. So there's loads of reasons why you'd want to do that. I think a space-based interferometer would be good. I mean, maybe, you know, there is a plan actually to do this in the future with a sort of space-based LIGO, so the interferometer that was used to detect gravitational waves recently. Putting one of those in space would be a remarkable thing to be able to do. There's a mission at the moment that's trying to test out the technology for that called LISA Pathfinder, and I think that will happen. But if money was no object, then maybe it would happen a bit quicker.
Yeah.
Not always, because you've got to get the people to do the actual work, and just throwing more money at something doesn't obviously solve anything. Stuff to search for life, I guess. Going for searching for life in the solar system, maybe on Enceladus or Europa, one of these moons of the giant planets. That would be an interesting project as well, I think. So something like that, probably.
Of course, you could also add a little bit of funding for the Jobcast if money was no constraint as well.
Just a bit.
Our next question is from Russ Jenkins. Why do they always say microgravity when they talk about life on the space station? Surely there is pretty much normal gravity, not much less than 1G up there, except that it doesn't feel like that as the station is in orbit. Doesn't that mean that the perceived gravity is neutral? Probably means zero.
Yeah, it is an interesting question. You do hear people will talk about microgravity on the space station. What I wanted to do was try and do some maths on the radio, or maths on the Jobcast.
That's quite risky.
If we can attempt to do this, but it sort of might illustrate the point. So the space station's at an altitude of about 400 kilometres above the Earth's surface. The Earth's radius is almost 6,400 kilometres, so you're basically talking about the difference between something on the Earth being at 6,400 kilometres from the middle of the Earth and something like the space station being 6,800 kilometres from the middle. So there's actually not a lot of difference in terms of the gravity you feel. So in fact, you can sort of work that out. We know that the acceleration due to gravity that's felt by something that's, say, a 1 kilogram mass, that's given by gm over r squared, where m is the mass of the Earth, r is the radius from the centre of the Earth. So you put in the mass of the Earth, you put in the radius of the Earth at the Earth's surface, and what you get is an acceleration due to gravity of 9.8 meters per second per second. That's the classic answer for the acceleration due to gravity. So if you drop something at the Earth's surface, that's the acceleration you get. If you put the same numbers in for the height of the space station, so the radius is slightly larger by 400 kilometres, you get 8.7 meters per second squared. So about 90% of the value at the Earth's surface. So it is a lower gravity at the height of the space station, but not by much.
Yeah.
So the question was, you know, what's microgravity, what's zero gravity? Well, although that's the pull of gravity, about 90% of what you feel at the Earth's surface while we're talking now, 90% of that is what you get in the space station. The space station's in orbit, so the space station's actually falling. If you were to sort of hold the space station still above the Earth and let go of it, it would drop down towards the Earth, of course. It would be pulled towards the centre of the Earth. If you move it sideways, it still falls, but it misses the edge of the Earth because the Earth curves around. So it continually goes round and round, missing the Earth as it falls. That's all an orbit is. So it's free fall. But that would be sort of zero gravity because it's a bit like, and I know this is a horrible thing to imagine, but it's a bit like getting in the lift and the lift cables snapping and you dropping in the lift. You'd be in free fall. So you can imagine sort of floating, it was a very high tower, floating inside this lift in the middle, and the lift and you would both be accelerating downwards at the same rate. So that's that sort of free fall. That would be zero gravity. So the question that Russ asked was, why do we not talk about zero gravity? Why do we talk about microgravity, since it's in this sort of free fall orbit? And actually, the reasons that I think, you know, they're quite interesting. One is that the space station, you know, you've seen pictures of Tim Peake or something on the space station and they're taking lovely photographs of the Earth out the window. There's windows that sort of look down at the Earth, and they stay pointing down at the Earth all the time as the space station rotates. So if you can imagine that, that actually means the space station is itself rotating at exactly the same rate at which it moves around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not sort of standing still in space as it orbits, because that would mean the windows would go from looking down at the Earth to looking directly away and then back again over one orbit. So the orbit's about 90 minutes. So actually the space station rotates with a period of about 90 minutes. Now, you know that if you were to sort of, you know, go on a fairground ride or a roundabout or something and you spin that roundabout, you get sort of, you feel this effective acceleration that flings you outwards from this rotating thing.
Yeah.
So the fact that the space station's rotating means that there's an effective acceleration felt that pushes you away from the centre of the space station. And you can actually work that out. And again, let's do a little bit of maths on the podcast. Let's attempt it anyway. For sort of circular motion, if you imagine sort of something rotating in a, you know, in a circular, around a circular path, then the acceleration that you feel is given by V squared over R. So V is the velocity or the speed at which you're moving, and R is the distance from the centre of rotation. So you can actually put into that equation, you can put in the fact that the period of this rotation for the space station is, say, 90 minutes, how long it takes to go around the Earth. So that basically tells you what the speed is, because it'd be 2 pi R would be the path of this thing divided by the period, 90 minutes. And that gives you an expression for the speed, which you can then put into that equation for the acceleration of V squared over R. And what you actually find is an acceleration of 1 micro g, so 1 millionth of the gravity at the surface of the Earth, you would actually find that acceleration would be at a distance of 7 meters from the centre of the space station.
Hmm.
If you work that equation out, which is quite interesting.
That is so interesting. Actually,
you only have to be the space station itself is maybe 100 meters across. So if you're 7 meters away from the sort of centre of rotation of that space station, you would feel this acceleration of 1 millionth of a G, which is a microgravity.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons why we don't talk about zero G. There are other reasons. Basically, it feels drag. So it's not as if there's space is a complete vacuum. At 400 kilometres, you've even got some residual atmosphere, but you've also got the interplanetary medium and so on. So the space station feels drag, and that would be felt as an acceleration on the space station. It has to boost its orbit occasionally because that drag can result in it changing its orbital radius, and it might have to accelerate in some way to adjust its orbit, so you'd feel that. And even the fact that at 100 metres across, the force of gravity you feel from the surface of the Earth changes over the size of the space station, because you know, one at the far side of the space station, you're slightly farther away from the Earth. So I think all those reasons combined mean that you never quite get zero G, and you do get about, you know, millionths of a little G, which is the acceleration of gravity at the Earth's surface.
Okay, thank you. So I'm guessing that means you wouldn't be able to detect it yourself if you're in the space station.
No, I don't think so. I mean, small effects, but I think it does explain why. I think it's true that when they fire the little rockets that move the space station around a little bit, whether they're jogging out of the way of an incoming bit of space junk or whether they're just adjusting their orbit because it's been decaying, I think they switch off some of the more sensitive experiments that require microgravity, because there is a significant acceleration at that point. So that's certainly measurable. Not sure whether the astronauts feel that. They might do. Not sure about that one, actually, but certainly they switch off the experiments.
Okay, thank you very much. Our final question comes from Twitter, from the user Malcontent. The universe is made up of mostly dark matter, which we cannot see. Is it possible the matter is actually held in black holes?
So I'm sure we've talked about dark matter on the Jobcast many, many, many times in the past.
I think once an episode, at least, yeah.
Okay, good. So we should, and it's appropriate, really, because dark matter is about five times the amount of the visible matter that we can see, so we should probably talk about dark matter more than we talk about normal matter. But yeah, the universe is, in terms of matter density, the universe is dominated by dark matter, and we don't know what it is yet. So the best, the most popular suggestions have been that it's some sort of particle physics explanation and a particle yet to be found. But there are other alternatives that have been discussed and you do see still being discussed. And one of them is, as Malcontent asks, maybe this dark matter is in black holes and that's why we wouldn't see it. So the sorts of things that you would think about here, one thing is called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So this is basically how the elements are made in the Big Bang. And so there are very brilliant models, really. I mean, one of the great pieces of evidence for the Big Bang, I mean, we've got the expanding universe. So if the universe is expanding, you sort of wind the clock back, you get a Big Bang. You've got the cosmic microwave background that we see as well. That's another great piece of evidence. But one of the other classic pieces of evidence is you can do the nuclear physics calculations that tell you how the elements are built up in the early minutes after the Big Bang. So when you've got, you know, high densities, the particles are packed closely together. You've got high temperatures, so they're whizzing around very fast. And you can actually calculate the nuclear reaction rates that let you build up these lightest elements, the hydrogen, the helium, the deuterium, and so on. And actually the matter density, what's called the baryonic matter density, so that's the not sort of normal matter like protons and neutrons, etc. That's a key parameter for these calculations. And you can fit the predictions of those models, those Big Bang nuclear synthesis models, to observations of the abundances of these light elements. So how many of these elements we see in space, maybe in quasar absorption spectra or something like that. And it turns out that puts a limit on the density of baryonic matter, which is much lower than the dark matter density. So you can't explain away dark matter with so-called baryonic matter, even if it is dark. So like, you know, brown dwarfs, planets, very faint stars, even these sort of, you know, small black holes and things which might have been formed during the evolution of the universe over the 14 billion years since the Big Bang. You could ask whether there are black holes around that have been around from the beginning, actually, which is a different question, really, than black holes that evolved, were formed during the evolution of the universe, like in stellar evolution or something. We don't really understand where the supermassive black holes came from at the centres of galaxies.
Yep.
Okay. And, you know, they may well have formed early on. We know galaxies merge, and we know that supermassive black holes get bigger because of mergers, but we don't know perhaps when the original black holes formed. However, they're not a good candidate for dark matter because we know dark matter is distributed quite broadly. So if you look at like gravitational lensing experiments and so on, we can sort of make maps of where the dark matter is. And it's not as if it's concentrated just in the centres of galaxies, which is where these supermassive black holes are.
Yeah.
It's spread through the whole galaxy, so it can't be in the form of these supermassive black holes. You can sort of rule that out. But there is another possibility, which are things called primordial black holes, which could be like small black holes that are made right at the beginning of the universe at some point. And so they don't, you get round the nuclear synthesis solution by doing that, by forming them early enough. So Stephen Hawking, you know, came up with this idea of Hawking radiation from black holes, from the sort of event horizon of a black hole. And he worked out that radiation would basically lead very low mass primordial black holes to evaporate. So if you formed them at the beginning, they would have all evaporated by now if the masses were less than a million kilograms. Now, it's a bit hard. I was actually just thinking, a million kilograms, what's a million kilograms? It's not hard to imagine. You could compare it to the mass of the sun. The sun is 2 times 10 to the 30.
Yeah.
So that's about 10 to the minus 18 times the mass of the sun.
Okay, so it's more comparable, smaller than the Earth, really, isn't it?
So it's smaller than the Earth, yeah. So in fact, this is my solution. I thought, I wonder what the volume of Loch Ness is. And this does, you know, the Loch Ness monster might be a particularly massive component of Loch Ness, but we'll ignore the Loch Ness monster, but just the water in Loch Ness apparently has a volume of 7.5 cubic kilometres.
Okay.
And if you turn that into a mass, a litre of water is a kilogram, then you get about 7.5 times 10 to the 12 kilograms. And Hawking ruled out these black holes with a mass less than 10 to the 12. So it's about the seventh the mass of Loch Ness. If that's any help. So we've ruled out Loch Ness-sized black holes, mass black holes. Of course, if they were black holes, their size would be tiny. If you turn the whole of the Earth mass into a black hole, it'd be about the size of a marble or something. So if you took the whole of Loch Ness water and turned it into a black hole, it'd be very tiny indeed. So these are sort of very microscopic black holes. Those would have evaporated, so it can't be that mass range. And people have been looking, you know, are there, you know, higher mass ones that might still be around? They use things like gravitational micro lensing. So this idea that you look at, you know, you look out through the halo of our galaxy and you can look at a star, and if a sort of one of these little black holes or something passes in front of the star, the light from the distant star is bent around it, and you actually get a sort of a focusing of the light. So actually the background star gets a bit brighter as something passes across the front of it. And that rules out quite a wide range of masses. There was a recent paper from using Kepler data, the transit telescope, that ruled out sort of things up to the sort of high end of what was possible, which was like getting on for the mass of the moon. So we were ruling out the sort of high end of that. And actually, the sort of lower end, so above Hawking's limit of Loch Ness size, Loch Ness mass things, up to, you know, the mass of several times the mass of a comet or something, that was actually recently ruled out by a study that showed that those type of primordial black holes would actually get trapped inside neutron stars.
Huh.
So if you imagine this sort of neutron star sitting there in space, and there's a sort of sea of dark matter made up of these primordial black holes, these tiny black holes, they would sort of collect in the inside. They would get trapped in the inside of a neutron star, and then if they get trapped inside, though, they just accrete the whole mass of the neutron star, and the neutron star disappears into the black hole. And the fact that we see neutron stars in regions where we know there's dark matter from these broader lensing studies basically puts limits on how many of those primordial black holes that can be around, and there just isn't enough of them to explain this dark matter density. So it really does look like, for lots of different reasons, which I've, you know, skated over, I know, it really does look like we can't explain dark matter by hiding stuff inside black holes. And so we come back to the particle physicists, or we come back to fiddling our equations of gravity with like modified Newtonian dynamics or something, which changes the law of gravity to explain away the dark matter effects.
Well, it's a shame, but we've got to leave the particle physicists with something to do.
It's true. They would get bored otherwise, wouldn't they?
Bored, yeah.
They found the Higgs boson, so they can get on with the dark matter search.
They've pretty much finished their job now, haven't they?
Yeah.
So, thank you very much, Tim O'Brien. Hopefully, we can get you on again in less than 2 years this time.
Yeah, I hope so.
Thank you very much.
Okay, cheers.
Thanks for that, Tim.
And now on to the feedback. I believe we have some post.
Yes, we do have some post. Here we go. So we've got a beautiful card with a photograph stuck to the front of it that looks like the sender took it themselves, which is really amazing because it's a beautiful photograph of the Milky Way. And it's captioned Death Valley at Night, North Cross and Star Vega over 20 Mule Wagon. Oh yeah, there's also a 20 Mule Wagon. I totally knew what that was. It's a lovely wagon. And inside we have some words. Hello, Jodcasters. Thanks for putting on such a great show. I love how you put science, astronomy and down-to-earth personality together. Your casual, personal approach to the show is what I love best. Thanks again, Rob Connolly. P.S. I picked this card for you at a recent Celestial Centennial event at Death Valley National Park in California. It's a great place to visit if you're ever looking for a great sky in the States. Come visit. Okay, so Rob didn't actually take the picture himself. It's by a fellow called Wally Pachalka from the America the Beautiful at Night series. So thank you, Rob, for picking out this lovely picture for us.
Thanks very much. Absolutely very nice. Gorgeous. And that sounded like an offer of a trip to America as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah. Can we all come visit?
We can stay
in the 20-mule wagon.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And on Facebook, we have a message from Philip Blurish, who says, I once used a computer program to predict the next transit of Mercury, but it didn't happen. I couldn't understand why until I realised that Mercury was passing behind the Sun. Moral of the tale, all second-order equations have two roots.
Ah, that's a tricky one.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, at least you worked it out.
Yeah, that's clever.
Probably have been taking me a lot longer.
Exactly.
And thanks for all the likes and shares.
On Twitter, we have a message from Susan on May the 8th. The Jodcast, love it, listen through the night, then just can't sleep. Oh, thank you, Susan. That's a good reason not to be able to sleep. It's a better reason than spiders. thank you for all the follows and retweets. And you can now find us on iTunes. Please rate us and review us.
And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can send us post. The address is on the website.
And thanks to Professor Philippa Browning and Dr. Sambit Roy Chowdhury for the interviews. The editors were Alex Clark, George Bendo, Christina Illy and Charlie Walker. The producer was Benjamin Shaw. Until next time,
Jod on!
And on Facebook, we have a message from Philip Lurish, who says, I once used a computer program to predict the next transit of Mercury, but it didn't happen. I couldn't understand why until I realised that Mercury was... And I once used a computer program. I'm going to... Oh, I can't speak today.
Oh, no. Oh, is it because you're nervous about having to wear a suit?
I wasn't.
Oh, don't be. You look amazing in the suit.
Oh, no.
You will.
No.
Everyone looks amazing in a suit,
no,
trust me.
Not me.
It's impossible not to look good. You look like James Bond.
James Bond the crystal meth years.
James Bond the PhD years.
Oh, God. Anyway. That's not going to be a good look.
Oh, deep breaths, everyone.
I'll fleetingly return to the script now.
Yeah.
And on Facebook, we have a message from Philip Blurish, who says, I want...